This is Amy Hall. I'm here with Greg Kogel, and you're listening to Hashtag STR Ask.
Hello, Amy, dear.
Hello, Greg. How are you doing today?
Wait, can I say that? Is that harassment?
I'll allow it.
Is that harassment? By the way, they should call it gender harassment, not sexual harassment. You know,
yeah, because that's a good point.
Because I don't know that necessarily when people do things like that, that some people complain about it has anything to do with the SEX. It's just a gender thing. But then there's no gender, right? There is no such thing. It's socially constructed. So what's the complaint?
But I identify.
Yes, you do. And you're not complaining. So that's great.
True.
Okay.
All right, let's get on to the questions.
Yes, dear.
All right. The first one comes from Caitlin Burton. And she asks, what do you think about Joel 2:31? And what does this mean that, and does this mean that blood moons will predict the season that the Lord returns in? And then she adds, I'm aware that none of us will know the exact time or day.
Oh, there's a whole lot I could say to this question. For one, let's go a bit to Joel 2:31 just to read it, jumping up a verse just to cover a little bit more of the flow of thought. This is under a heading in my Bible, the Day of the Lord. So the editors saw this next passage dealing with the Day of the Lord. They're probably right. I will display wonders in the sky and on the earth. Blood, fire, and columns of smoke. The sun will be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes. And it will come about that whoever calls on the name of the Lord will be delivered. For on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem there will be those who escape, etc. So this is a reference that sounds like apocalyptic in some sense. And it uses the phrase, the moon will be turned into blood, all right? Now, I know we have this thing called a blood moon. I'm not entirely sure what that is in common parlance, but it has to do with, it's not like a fifth moon, a second full moon in a month. That's a blue moon.
Yeah, I'm actually not absolutely certain about that.
But apparently there's been a few blood moons more than usual this year.
Yes.
Whatever that is. Keep in mind, by the way, just because of this, and I got to look it up, this thing, phenomena that we now call a blood moon, not just because we call this thing a blood moon now, doesn't mean that the same phenomena was called a blood moon by Jews. This is Joel. So what is that, you know, 25 to 3,000 years ago? There are many occasions where we will take common terms in our usage and then read the same terms in the Old Testament or somewhere in Scripture and read our meanings back into those ancient words in a way that those ancient writers did not intend them. It's a kind of anachronism. And so in other words, when you see Scripture talking about guarding your heart, well, people think, well, see, make sure your emotions don't get out of control. But you see, in the Scripture, the heart was not the center of the emotions. The bowels were the center of the emotions in a biblical characterization. It was rather the heart was the center of one's being, you know. And so this may be one problem here. And the thing that may be the problem is that there's a concept we have of a blood moon that doesn't necessarily mean that moons that looked like blood were the same so-called blood moons that we're referring to now that we see happening a lot. And if we see it happening a lot, that may be a fulfillment of this prophecy in Joel. You get my drift here. No, that's kind of a reach. It's not clear to me that that's the case at all. Secondly, or maybe thirdly, I've lost count. It says the moon, the sun will be turned into darkness and the moon into blood. Okay. Now, clearly this can't be taken literally because the moon isn't going to be turned into blood. It could be bloody looking, just like the sun isn't turned into darkness, but maybe it's blotted out for some reason. Okay. Well, we just had some big fires in Southern California. All right. And that has a tendency of blotting out the sun a bit and changing the colors of the lights coming through it, you know. And so, this could be not referring to some status of the moon, but just the reality of destruction that will accompany the second coming of Christ or the day of the Lord or something like that. I guess the point I'm making is there are all kinds of possibilities about what could be meant by Joel's reference to the moon turning into blood. And we should be really careful about thousands of years later trying to read some modern thing into it and then see that as a sign of the second coming of Christ.
Especially since I think what people are saying now is that there were a certain number this year. There were a certain that they say indicates that, but that says nothing about the number or the
No, it just
whatever.
Says so the moon will be turned to blood. It didn't say there'd be a lot of bloody moons.
So if that's what it meant, then it would have happened before now because, I mean, if seeing a blood moon meant this is when the Lord's coming, it would have happened before now.
I mean, with the first advent of a blood moon.
Right.
And it may just be saying that there will be a blood moon when Jesus comes, just like, that's like saying in the moon will be full. Well, there's lots of full moons, but on this occasion, there will also be a full moon. So it tells us nothing about timing at all. All right, and this is where I get a little exasperated with Christians who get worked up about maybe current events or actually not even so much current events, but things like this that are so far removed, it seems to me, from the prophecy. It isn't like you can really tie anything together here with that, but apparently some people are doing that.
Yeah.
One last comment about the Matthew 24 comment, the Olivet Discourse, where Jesus says, no man knows the day or the hour. That isn't what, well, actually the way people usually quote it is, and I'm not sure how that person did it in the question, but no one will know. What does it say there?
None of us will know the exact time.
Yeah, see, none of us will know the exact time or day. That isn't what Jesus said. He has asked a specific question, and he gives a specific answer to that. What will be the signs of your coming, the sign of your coming and something like that, whatever, and when will these things take place? What will be the signs of your coming? In any event, Jesus says he gives general signs in answer, but then as of the exact time, he says no man knows. That's present tense. He doesn't say no person will know in the future. He says, right now, I can't tell you because that's unknown. Now, I'm not encouraging people to predict dates. I'm just looking at a certain detail of this exhortation by Jesus or this response by Jesus. Because this is Jesus, the incarnate Son of Man, of God, rather, that is saying no one knows, not even me. So my question to others is, do you think Jesus knows now?
Yeah,
I suspect too. Then that verse doesn't apply to the present moment because Jesus does know now. He didn't know then. And that was the question that was asked him. So you can't disqualify, in a sense, date setting based on that verse. You might disqualify it for other reasons, but not based on that verse, because it seems to me that verse no longer applies because Jesus does know now as the resurrected Son of God.
I never noticed that difference in there before.
Yeah. So just something to think about.
Okay, well, let's go to the next question. It comes from Jay Odermatt, and he asks, is it wrong to get mad at God?
Well, I don't know of a biblical prohibition against it. It says, be angry and do not sin. In Ephesians, so it's possible to be angry in a non-sinful way.
Towards God, though?
Well, we'll get there. Was Jesus ever angry? Yeah, Jesus was angry a number of times. Well, what about Jesus was never angry at God? No, that's true, okay, but that doesn't mean that it's wrong if we are angry towards God, okay? Do we have any indication that anybody else in the Bible was angry towards God? And yet wasn't upbraided for it or doesn't appear that this is a wrong thing. And it strikes me, frankly, in the Psalms We actually have a number of examples of David pouring out his frustration, maybe even anger, towards God. Look at, I just read this the other day, and I've read it quite a number of times of late. And hold on, got to find it now. I just got to turn to it. I know where it's at. It's easy to remember. It's Psalm 13. I like the unlucky number, easy to remember. Psalm 13. All right, hold on. Got a lot of pages in my Bible, a lot of books. Psalm 13 starts out, "How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long shall I take counsel in my soul, having sour in my heart all day? How long will my enemy be exalted over me?" I like that. Now, of course, I'm putting a little emotion into it, and somebody might think, well, that may not have been David's emotion. But as I read it, I take frustration out of this, bordering on anger. And that's just one that comes right to mind. There's a lot of Psalms that are like this. And so I don't think anger is wrong, and I don't think anger towards individuals is in itself wrong, and I don't see how anger towards God is itself wrong. I think God can handle our frustration and anger, if you will, towards him. I will tell you quite candidly, of course, this doesn't mean that it's okay, but I have expressed my anger to God many, many, many times. And once in a while, I feel like maybe I just overdid it a little bit in the sense of maybe expressing myself in a disrespectful way. And I think that would be an appropriate issue. And in those times, that's when I apologize to God, confessed, if you will. But I don't think the act of being angry towards God is itself a sin. I don't think it's going to help anybody to say, don't be angry towards God when they're really angry. I think it's better to take our issues, if you will, even regarding God, directly to God himself. And what we've seen in David's case, and I have experienced in my own case, is that as we pour out our souls to God in an authentic and genuine way, that often has a salutary effect. And in fact, the last line of two lines of Psalm 13, "But I have trusted in your loving kindness. My heart shall rejoice in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord because he has dealt bountifully with me." And I think what we see there in Psalm 13 is a pattern of starting in anger, expressing himself, his frustrations in honesty and integrity before God, and then being formed in that process by the truth.
I think it depends on how you're defining anger. If you're saying expressing emotion and lamenting and saying how this has hurt you and affected you with emotion, I think that's fine. But I think a lot of people would assume that anger means some sort of accusation.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say, I think here we see Job. Job was upset, clearly. Mm-hmm. And then God said, but in all this, he didn't sin.
Mm-hmm.
He never accused God of wrongdoing. And I think that's where anger moves into sin. I don't think there's any problem with expressing your deep hurt and even, you know, loudly and angrily.
Because if you accuse God of wrongdoing, then you're accusing him of something vile.
Right.
That's inconsistent with who he actually is.
You're saying he doesn't love you, he doesn't care about you, maybe he's not sovereign, whatever it is.
Right. Right.
So I think that's where it can move into sin.
Yeah, I think that's a good observation. Sure.
All right.
Good.
Is that all you have to say on that, Greg?
I'm too mad to say anything more.
All right, let's go on to the next one.
Okay.
This one comes from Sustained by Faith 7. And this person asks, and they're going to ask about a Greek word, and I have no idea if I'm pronouncing it right, so I'll just give it a shot. If the Greek word pharmakia means drug-related sorcery, and that is where we get our English word pharmaceutical, should Christians avoid using prescription drugs?
I think this is an example of what D.A. Carson calls a root word fallacy. Okay, so because this word in the Greek has a similar root and, you know, linguistic heritage, so to speak, and they call it etymology, as our word pharmakia, it doesn't mean that the words are really talking about the same kind of thing. Yeah, they're in broadly in the same class, but it doesn't necessarily mean that, gee, if sorcery, which is our English word for a translation of a word pharmakia that has a similar root to pharmacy, that means if sorcery is wrong, then therefore pharmaceuticals are wrong. What if we didn't call them pharmaceuticals? What if we just called them drugs? Got rid of the pharmaceutical word because it has that connection with, well, you know, then you could see now you've kind of done an end around the objection. If the objection is simply just tied to the etymologies of these similar, I should say these words that have similar etymologies. The key issue is meanings. Regardless of the etymology, how is the word being used in the biblical sense, and is the word that has a similar etymology that we're using now in an English application, is it mean the same kind of thing? Well, no. Going to the drugstore to get, you know, drugs for your kids, like I did 2 days ago for my daughter, is not the same as practicing sorcery, even though pharmakia and pharmacology kind of have a similar root. It's irrelevant. That's what's called the root word fallacy.
All right. That sounds like a good answer, Greg.
Thank you.
All right. Let's do one more.
All right.
This one comes from Daryl Harmon. And full disclosure, this is my brother-in-law.
Oh, really? Okay.
So he tweeted...
Better be good.
He tweeted, what's the difference between hermeneutics and homiletics? Which is better, or are there concerns with either of them?
Oh, they're just... It's apples and oranges. Hermeneutics is... it's like the discipline or the practice of interpretation. And we all practice hermeneutics all the time because we have to hear or read words and then figure out what the author of those words means. Okay? And so we're looking at things like the context and the environment and the culture and how the sentence structure and flow of thought and all that kind of stuff. The things that we do normally without thinking much about it when we read a newspaper, and then we go goofy when we read the Bible because then we apply all kinds of different rules to the process. Well, nobody knows what this means. Do you mean it literally? Oh, come on. Just read it. So that's what hermeneutics is. Homiletics is the discipline or the area of preaching. Okay? So they're just two different disciplines. Now, if you want to preach well, presuming we're talking about preaching the Bible, then you better have good hermeneutics, because in your preaching, you are exhorting regarding what you understand the book to be saying. And if you don't get the meaning right, then your homiletics, as clever as they may be, are going to be misguided. Okay, you're going to be very powerfully preaching and teaching and in a compelling way things that aren't accurate. That's bad. So we don't want to do that. So we want to get our hermeneutics right. And if we're preachers, then we want to be careful about being effective communicators. And that's the year of homiletics. That work? I think your brother-in-law will be happy with that?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Thank you, Greg.
Is he in the ministry?
No, he's not. He's a music teacher.
Oh, okay.
All right. Well, please send us your questions on Twitter and try to use 140 characters or less. Keep them short and use the hashtag STRask. So we look forward to hearing from you. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel, and you're listening to hashtag STRask.